The following are the short appendices of Mahabharata relating to Karna's birth, Karna being cursed, Bhishma Dev's heavenly origin, and questions posed by Dharma to Yudhisthira. Appendix 1. Karna's birth. Once the great sage Durvasa visited King Kuntibhoja. He stayed for some days in the king's palace and was attended by Kunti, then a young girl. Due to her expert service and humble attitude, the sage became pleased with her. He gave her a mantra with which she could summon any god and have him do her bidding. After that sage had left, Kunti was sitting alone in her room. She gazed out of her window and saw the sun rising. Suddenly, she found herself gifted with celestial sight. She was able to see the personified form of the sun. Seeing the effulgent and beautiful deity, her mind became attracted. She began to wonder about the mantra. Did it actually work? Could she summon the sun god himself? She recited the mantra as she thought of Surya. To her amazement, he appeared before her, filling her room with brilliance. The deity, who had a complexion like molten gold, was adorned with shining bracelets and a diadem, and he smiled at the astonished maiden. "What would you have me do?" he asked. Kunti almost cowered before the god. "O Lord, go back to the place from where you came," she replied in a bashful voice. "It was only childish curiosity that made me call for you. Pray forgive me for my folly." "O slender-waisted girl, I will return as you request, but first I must do something for you. It is not proper that my visit should go in vain." "Indeed, the god's acts always bear fruit. You have desired me. I will therefore bestow upon you a splendid child, furnished with his own armor and celestial earrings to endow him with full power." Kunti's mouth fell open in horror as the god continued, "O maiden, I will leave only after having enjoyed you. If you do not comply with my words and gratify my desire, then I will curse you, your father, and the Brahman who foolishly gave you the mantra without knowing your character." Surya told Kunti that all the other gods were laughing at him to see his plight. The girl had called him with desire in her heart and was now rejecting him. He would not leave without giving her a son. Kunti spoke in an imploring voice, "O great Lord of rays, please go to your own abode. Surely such an outrage is not befitting you. I am a maiden and cannot surrender myself to a man until I am properly married. My father, mother, or other superiors must first bestow me upon another. I will not abandon virtue. In this world, keeping her body pure is considered a woman's highest duty." Kunti again explained that it had only been childishness and naivete that had made her use the mantra. She begged the god to forgive her and to leave. Surya would not relent. "It is because you are only a girl that I am already so lenient. Where others might have been punished for insulting me so, I am instead offering you the boon of a powerful child like myself. If I go without enjoying you, I will be the object of ridicule among the celestials. Therefore surrender yourself to me and receive a son who will be extolled in all the worlds." Afraid to commit sin, Kunti repeatedly tried to sway the god from his purpose, but to no avail. He remained unmoved. Finally she said, "O Lord of the world, how will I be saved from sin and the world's censure? How will the reputation of my house be protected? It seems that my surrendering to you is an act condemned by Scripture. Please instruct me how it may be done without my losing my chastity. Surely the virtue, reputation, and indeed the life of all beings rests in you. Tell me how your proposal may be consistent with virtue." Surya assured her that there would be no sin in her having intercourse with him. "How could I, who desires the welfare of all beings, cause anyone to commit a sinful act which leads only to suffering? Do not fear. Even after uniting with me, you will remain a virgin. O fair-complexioned girl, you need have no doubt." Assured, and seeing that she had no choice, Kunti assented to the god's request. He at once entered her by his yogic power, and, overwhelmed by his energy, she fell senseless to her bed. The god then departed. 10 months later, Kunti gave birth to a son, as beautiful as a celestial. No one but one or two of her most trusted servants knew of her pregnancy and of the birth. When the child was born, Kunti saw that he was adorned with bright earrings and a natural coat of mail. His eyes resembled those of a lion, and his shoulders, even as a newborn baby, were broad. Kunti consulted with her nurse as to what to do with the boy. She was torn. This was her firstborn son, the offspring of the powerful sun god. But how could she keep him? Although the deity had assured her that she would remain a virgin, who would believe it? How could it ever be acceptable for a maiden to have a child? Who would accept her as a wife if she had already given birth? Kunti finally concluded that the baby had to be cast away. He was the great Surya's son. Surely Surya would protect him. Kunti also prayed to Vishnu for the boy's welfare. Then, along with her nurse, she took the child in a large wicker basket to the bank of the Ganges. She sat on the river bank, gazing at the baby for some time. Tears fell from her eyes, and she cried out in pain as she contemplated losing the child. Her anguished voice carried across the water. "O my son, may all the creatures inhabiting the earth, heavens, and waters protect you. May Varuna, god of the waters, and Pavana, god of the winds, carry you safely away. May your powerful father, the god of shining rays, watch over you." Kunti beseeched many of the gods to look after her son, and prayed that he would find a good father and mother. "How fortunate is she who will adopt you as her son," she cried. "Blessed is that lady who will see you crawl on the ground, your radiant face covered in dust, and your dark and curling locks strewn about. Fortunate are they who will hear your inarticulate speech, and who will see you grow to manhood, like a lion in the Himalayan forests." Having wept long and bitterly, Kunti at last closed the basket and pushed it out into the flowing river. She watched it as it bobbed away on the waters. Then, supported by her nurse, she made her way back to the palace. The basket finally came to rest in still waters near the city of Champa. There Adirath, the leader of the Suta tribe, had gone to the river with his wife Radha. The lady saw the basket and had it brought onto the bank. When it was opened, the couple saw with amazement the effulgent child lying there. Radha at once took the infant onto her lap and asked her husband if she could take him home. She had been praying to the gods for a son and considered that this baby must be a gift from them. With her husband's permission, she brought the child home and raised him with tenderness as her own son. They named him Vasusena, but later he became known as Karna or Radeya. Appendix 2. Karna Cursed. When Karna attained manhood, he approached Drona in order to learn the secrets of the Brahmastra. Drona replied, however, that the knowledge he desired should only be given to a qualified Brahmin who had practiced vows, or to an accomplished Kshatriya who had undergone penance. "O Radeya, you are neither. Indeed, you hail from the Suta class of Sudras. I will not instruct you." Burning with anger, Karna bowed before Drona and left for the Mahendra mountain, where he knew he would find Parasaram. When he found the sage, Karna bowed at his feet and said, "I am a Brahmin from Bhrigu's race. Kindly instruct me in weaponry. I desire to know the Brahmastra." Parasaram received him kindly and agreed to teach him. Karna then lived at the sage's ashram and learned many types of warfare and weaponry from him. While residing on the heavenly mountain, he became a favorite of the many Siddhas and Gandharvas who sported there. He would often go about with his bow and sword, hunting game and wild beasts. Once, while hunting, he accidentally slew a Brahmin's cow. Distraught, he went at once to the Brahmin and told him what happened. Dropping to the ground before the sage, he said in a tearful voice, "O best of men, I have killed your cow quite against my will and desire. Forgive me. Please allow me to make some recompense." But the Brahmin, seeing his beloved cow lying dead, was filled with anger. His face turned red, and he took hold of his sacred thread, signifying his intention to curse Karna. "O wicked one, you deserve death for this crime. You will suffer the fruit of your foolishness even in this life. When you finally meet in battle with your mortal enemy, your chariot will be swallowed by the earth. As you have carelessly cut down my cow, so your head will be cut off by your foe. Go now, O vile man." Karna tried to appease the Brahmin, but he would not relent. "My words will not prove false," he replied. Finally, Karna went away, hanging his head in sorrow. Karna remained in Parasuram's ashram for some time, pleasing the sage by his aptitude for learning and by his humble service attitude. Parasuram taught him everything about the Brahma weapon, as well as other powerful missiles, such as the mighty Bhargava Astra. One day, the sage took a walk in the woods, taking Karna with him. After some time, he became tired and lay down to rest on a grassy slope, placing his head on Karna's lap. As the rishi slept, a large insect crawled onto Karna's leg and began to burrow into his flesh. Digging deeply, the insect drank Karna's blood. Not wanting to disturb his guru, Karna did not move. He sat without showing the least sign of pain. After some minutes, his warm blood ran onto Parasuram's face and awakened him. When he saw the eight-legged insect on Karna's leg, he melted it with his glance. A Rakshasa suddenly rose into the sky and addressed Parasuram with folded palms. "O best of ascetics, you have saved me from a hellish existence. Formerly I lived in the higher planets, but one day I assaulted Bhrigu's wife, who cursed me to become an insect. When I begged for mercy, he told me I would be released from the curse when I came in contact with Rama, the son of Jamadagni. You have rescued me. Thank you, O sage. I will now depart." The Rakshasa vanished, leaving the rishi glaring at Karna. "O wretch," he exclaimed, "how can you be a Brahmin? No Brahmin could tolerate such pain. Only a Kshatriya has such patience. Tell me the truth. Who are you?" Trembling, Karna replied, "O Lord, I am Karna, and I have been born in the Suta race, a mixture of Brahmins and Kshatriyas. Coming to you as my teacher, O scion of the Bhrigu line, I saw you as my father. Thus I did call myself a member of Bhrigu's family. Forgive me, for I am your humble servant." Parasuram smiled through his anger. Looking down at Karna, who had prostrated himself on the earth with folded palms, the sage said, "Greedy for weapons, you have lied to me. Therefore I say this: when you face your greatest danger and desperately need your most powerful celestial weapon, you will not be able to remember the mantras. Otherwise, you will be peerless in weaponry. Now leave at once, for this is no place for one who behaves falsely." Karna left, feeling great shame, and later joined Duryodhan in Hastinapur. Appendix 3. Bhishma's Heavenly Origin. In ancient times, there lived a king named Mahavisha. During his long life, he performed great sacrifices, and as a result, ascended to Indra's abode at the end of his life. Once, in an assembly of the gods, with Brahma present, Mahavisha saw the divinely beautiful Ganga. As he looked at her, a gust of wind suddenly blew away her garments. All the celestials looked away, but Mahavishnu continued to gaze at her, captivated by her beauty. For this rudeness, Brahma cursed him as follows: "You will again be born on earth, but you will return here after one life." Mahavishnu thought for a moment, remembering all the monarchs on earth. Among them all, he considered a king named Pratipa to be the most pious. He therefore asked Brahma if he might become Pratipa's son, to which Brahma agreed. Ganga, having seen Mahavishnu's unshamed attraction for her, left the assembly thinking of him. As she went away, she came across the Vasus, who looked dejected. When she asked them the cause of their despondency, they replied, "We have been cursed by the powerful Rishi Vasishtha. Thus we must soon take birth as men on earth. For this we are sorry." Ganga heard how the 8 Vasus had tried to take from Vasishtha his heavenly cow, Nandini. Their leader, Dayu, had been implored by his wife to seize the cow, which was able to give anything one desired. Dayu had assented to his wife's request, and with his brother's assistance, had stolen the cow. When Vasishtha discovered the theft, he was furious. Understanding by his mystic power that the Vasus were responsible, he touched holy water and uttered his curse. The Vasus soon learned of the curse and went before the Rishi, remorsefully returning the cow and begging his forgiveness. But Vasishtha said his words could not prove false. Repeatedly requested for mercy, he finally said, "You 8 Vasus will all be born on earth, but you will be freed from the curse quickly. Only Dayu, the chief culprit, will have to remain on earth for a full lifetime. He will be virtuous, powerful, and learned in the Vedas, but he will not beget offspring. Indeed, he will have to abstain from the pleasures of women." The Vasus asked Ganga to go to earth as a woman and become their mother, as they did not wish to enter the womb of any human woman. When Ganga asked who they would choose as their father, they replied, "There is a king named Pratipa who will soon have a son named Shantanu. That prince is destined to become our father." Ganga was delighted. Shantanu would be an incarnation of Mahavishnu. She smiled, "I will surely become your mother. Go where you will, we will soon meet again." In due course, the Vasus fell from heaven, and Ganga left for earth. Soon after, Shantanu, while wandering along the banks of the Ganges, met the goddess. Struck by her beauty, he felt his hair stand on end. Her features were flawless, and she was adorned with fine silk robes, as beautiful as the filaments of lotus flowers. His mouth dropped open, and he could not take his eyes from her. Ganga was also attracted to the handsome monarch, and she returned his gaze, her dark eyes meeting his and sending a thrill through his body. Moving closer to her, Shantanu said, "O beautiful one, whether you are a goddess, a Gandharvi, a Danava, an Asura, or an Apsara, I beg you to become my wife. You seem to have no protector. Allow me to become your shelter." Ganga glanced down demurely. "O king, I will become your wife and obey your commands, but I will make one condition. You must not interfere with my acts, whether they are agreeable or not. You must also never address me in harsh words. If you act in this way, I will remain with you. But if you act otherwise, I will leave immediately." The king hardly gave any thought to her request. "Be it so," he replied at once. He brought her back to Hastinapur, and the marriage ceremony was performed that same day. Absorbed in Ganga's celestial beauty, Shantanu did not notice the passage of time. After a year together, which seemed to him like a few days, Ganga gave birth to a son. Within days of the birth, she threw the baby into the Ganges, where it was swept away by the waters. Although horrified, Shantanu remembered Ganga's conditions and kept silent, not wanting to lose her. Each year, for 7 years, a boy was born. And each time, Ganga took the child to the river and cast him into the water. The king managed to restrain himself. But when Ganga was about to drown the 8th child, he could take no more. He ran after her, shouting, "Stop, O cruel woman! Why are you killing our children? Murderess of your sons, you are earning great sins by your acts." Ganga stopped by the river bank and turned toward Shantanu. "As you desire a child, I will not kill this one. O king, take the child and raise him as your son. He will doubtlessly bring glory to your line. But in accordance with our agreement, I must now leave." Ganga then revealed her identity to the mystified king. She told him about Vasishtha's cursing of the Vasus. "I have thus released the gods from the Rishi's curse. This 8th child is Dayu, who must remain on earth for a full lifetime." Understanding the situation and realizing that everything had been ordained by destiny, Shantanu tried to change Ganga's mind, but she was resolute. The king then asked that she take the baby with her to the celestial regions. When the child became a young man, he could return to earth. Ganga agreed. Holding the baby close to her breast, she vanished into the river. Shantanu returned in sorrow to his capital, Hastinapur. He continued ruling the people, becoming famous for his virtue. He was loved by the citizens and ruled the world with justice and compassion. It was said that if he simply placed his hand on someone, that person would immediately be relieved of all material pains and anxiety. One day, some years after Ganga had left, the king was hunting near the Ganges. As he pursued a deer along the river bank, he noticed that the river water, which had previously been deep and flowing, had become a trickle. Marveling, the king made his way upriver to find the cause. He soon came across a godlike youth who resembled Indra himself. The amiable-looking boy was holding a large bow. It seemed he had checked the river's flow by damming it with arrows. The king was astonished at this remarkable feat and gazed at the youth, trying to ascertain his identity. The boy suddenly disappeared, and the king, suspecting that it was his son, said to the river, "O Ganga, show me my child." As soon as he spoke, the goddess rose from the waters, holding the boy by his hand. She approached the king and said, "Here is the 8th son whom we conceived together. O great king, take him now. I have reared him carefully, instructed by rishis such as Vasishtha, Shukra, and Parasaram. He has become proficient in all aspects of Vedic knowledge and is expert in arms and warfare." Ganga then vanished, leaving the boy with Shantanu. The king took him back to the city, where he would later become famous as Bhishma. Appendix 4. Questions posed by Dharma to Yudhisthira. The following questions are not included in the main text. What makes one learned? How does one attain an exalted status? What is one's second self? And by what does one become wise? By study of the Vedas, one becomes learned. Asceticism raises one to an exalted status. Intelligence is one's second self, and serving elders makes one wise. What is the Brahman's divine attribute? What is their virtuous practice resembling that of the pious? And what is their human attribute? And what practice of theirs resembles that of the impious? Study of the Vedas is the Brahman's divine attribute. Their asceticism is like virtuous practice of the pious. Death is their human attribute, and slander by them is their impiety. What is the divine attribute of Kshatriyas? What is their piety and impiety? And what is their human failing? Arrows and weapons constitute their divinity. Sacrifice is their piety, and abandoning the distressed, their impiety. Fear is their human failing. What is the sama of sacrifice? What is its yajur? And what can it not do without? Life is the sacrificial sama. Mind is its yajur. And it is the rig which it cannot do without. Yudhisthira understood his actual meaning. By sacrifice, he meant the spiritual sacrifice for obtaining pure knowledge. In the worldly or objective sacrifice, which one normally performs with fire and mantras, the three Vedas, Sama, Yajur, and Rig, are required. In the subjective or spiritual sacrifice, the acquisition of true knowledge, along with life and mind, are as necessary as the mantras of the three Vedas are for the objective sacrifice. Particularly, spiritual sacrifice depends upon prayer, which is represented by the Rig mantras. The Yaksha went on without pause. What is of greatest value to cultivators, to those that sow, to those wishing for prosperity, and to those who bring forth? Rain is the most valuable thing for cultivators. For sowers, it is the seed. For those desiring prosperity, it is the cow. And for those who bring forth, it is the sun. What person, although breathing, endowed with intelligence, respected by the world, and enjoying sensual pleasures, is nevertheless said to not be alive? The person who does not satisfy the gods, guests, servants, ancestors, and his own self with offerings of sanctified food is said to be dead even though breathing. What is weightier than the earth? What is higher than the sky? What is fleeter than the wind? And what is more numerous than grass? The mother is weightier than the earth. The father is higher than the sky. Mind is fleeter than the wind, and thoughts are more numerous than the grass. Yudhisthira understood that by serving the mother, one was said to obtain the earth, and by serving the father, one could rise to heaven. The Yaksha continued, "What does not close its eyes when sleeping? What does not move after birth? What has no heart, and what swells with its own force? Fish do not close their eyes while sleeping. Eggs do not move after birth. A stone has no heart, and a river swells with its own force. Who is the friend of an exile, of a householder, of a sick person, and of a dying man? An exile's friend is his companion. That of a householder is his wife. The physician is a sick person's friend, and charity is a dying man's friend. Who is the guest of all creatures? What is the eternal religion? O King of Kings, what is life-giving nectar, and what pervades this entire universe? Agni is the guest of all creatures. Cow's milk is life-giving nectar. Offering ghee into fire sacrifices made to the Lord is the eternal religion, and this entire universe is pervaded by air. What is it that wanders alone? What is born again after its birth? What is the antidote to cold? And what is the largest field? The sun wanders alone. The moon is repeatedly born. Agni is cold's antidote, and the earth is the largest field. What is the highest refuge of virtue? What of fame? What of heaven? And what of happiness? Liberality is virtue's highest refuge. Fame's refuge is charity. Heaven's refuge is truth. And of happiness, the highest refuge is good conduct. What is the soul of a man? Who is the friend given to him by destiny? What is his chief support? And what is his chief refuge? The soul of a man is his son. His wife is the friend given by destiny. clouds are his principal support, and charity his best refuge. What is the best of all laudable objects, of all sorts of wealth, and of all kinds of happiness? And what is the most important of all gains? Skillfulness is the most laudable object. Knowledge is the greatest wealth. Health is the greatest gain, and contentment is the highest happiness. What is the greatest virtue in the world? What religion always bears fruits? And what is that which, if controlled, never leads men to misery? And with whom does friendship never break? Abstention from harming any creature is the greatest virtue. The religion of the three Vedas is always fruitful. The mind, if controlled, never leads to misery, and friendship with the righteous never breaks. What is it that by renouncing makes a man dear to others? What is it which, if given up, never leads to misery? What is that which, if renounced, leads to wealth? And what is it which, if renounced, leads to happiness? Giving up pride makes one dear. Abandoning anger never leads to misery. Desire, if renounced, makes one wealthy. And abandonment of avarice leads to happiness. For what does one give charity to Brahmins, to dancers, to servants, and to kings? One gives to Brahmins for religious merit, to dancers for renown, to servants for their support, and one gives to kings for freedom from fear. What is it that envelops the world? What prevents a thing from discovering itself? Why are friends forsaken? And what prevents one from going to heaven? The world is enveloped with darkness. Spiritual ignorance prevents self-discovery. Friends are forsaken due to avarice, and connection with the world bars one from heaven. For what is a person regarded as dead? What causes a kingdom to be seen as dead? And what makes a sacrifice dead? A poor person, although living, is considered good as dead. A kingdom without a king is considered dead, and a sacrifice without charity is dead. What is the path one should follow? What is spoken of as water, as food, and as poison? What is the proper time for a shraddha? Following in the footsteps of the righteous constitutes the proper path. Space is spoken of as water in the Vedic texts on cosmogony. The cow is considered food, as it is from milk that ghee is obtained. Ghee is then used in sacrifices, and thanks to sacrifices there is rainfall, from which we get food grains. A request is poison. The proper time for a shraddha is whenever a qualified Brahmin is available. Yudhisthira was unsure if his answers were satisfying the Yaksha. He looked at him quizzically. "What is your opinion, O Yaksha?" But the Yaksha simply went on placing more questions. "What is the characteristic of true asceticism? What of self-control? What constitutes forgiveness and shame?" Following one's religious duties is asceticism. Self-control means keeping the mind fixed in remembrance of the Lord. Forgiveness consists of tolerating enmity, and freedom from shame means abstaining from all vile acts. O King, what is said to be knowledge? What is tranquility? What is known as the greatest kindness? And what is simplicity? Understanding Brahman is true knowledge. A peaceful heart is tranquility. Kindness consists of a desire for the welfare of all creatures, and simplicity means equanimity of mind. What is man's invincible enemy? What is his incurable disease? What man is regarded as honest and what is dishonest. Anger is the invincible enemy. Covetousness is the incurable disease. A man who is friendly to all creatures is honest, and the cruel man dishonest. What, O great monarch, is known as ignorance? What is spoken of as pride? What is understood to be idleness? And what is called grief? Not knowing one's religious duties is ignorance. Pride means thinking oneself to be the doer of acts in this world, without recognizing that there is a supreme power in control of everything. Idleness is not performing one's religious duty, and ignorance is grief. What is known by the rishis as steadiness, and what is patience? What is said to be the best ablution, and what is spoken of as charity? Steadiness means adhering firmly to one's religious duties. Patience is controlling the senses. The highest ablution is to cleanse the mind of all impurities, and charity means to protect all creatures. Who is considered learned? Who is an atheist? Who is ignorant? What is spoken of as desire, and what is envy? One who knows his duties is learned. An ignorant man is an atheist, and thus is an atheist ignorant. Desire means longing for worldly things, and envy is nothing more than grief of the heart. What is hypocrisy? What is the grace of the gods? And what is called wickedness? Falsely posing as a religious man is called hypocrisy. The grace of the gods is a result of charity. Wickedness means slandering others. Virtue, profit, and pleasure are opposed to one another. How can these three coexist? When a husband and wife are happily united for the purposes of performing religious duties, then these three can exist together harmoniously. Who, O best of the Bharatas, is doomed to eternal damnation? Speedily answer this question of mine. One who summons a Brahman for alms, but then gives nothing, is condemned to everlasting hell. He also goes to unending hell who denies the truth of the Vedas, the Brahmins, the gods, and the religion of his forefathers. Also that man who, although wealthy, refuses to give charity, must suffer everlasting damnation. O King, tell me with certainty, what makes one a Brahmin? Is it birth, good character, learning, or study of the Vedas? Hear, O Yaksha, O worshipable one, what are the true characteristics of a Brahmin? It is by behavior alone that he is recognized. Birth and learning, even knowledge of all the Vedas, are useless if there is no good character. He alone is a Brahmin who performs his religious duties, offering sacrifices and keeping his senses under control. Otherwise, he must be considered no better than a Sudra. What is gained by agreeable speech? What is gained by he who acts only after careful thought? What does the man with many friends gain? And what does he gain who is ever given to virtue? One who speaks agreeably becomes dear to all. One who acts with care obtains whatever he seeks. The man with many friends lives happily in this life, and the virtuous man obtains happiness in the next life. The remainder of the questions and answers from this point are included in the text of chapter 34.